5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on. Panic Room Radio Show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, good evening, listener. It's come round quick again, hasn't it? It is Thursday night, 9:30 Central, and it is episode, would you believe, 76 of the, I was going to say the all-new Panic Room, but it's not. It's same old, really, to be honest. We've been going 76 episodes now, and it is the same old, isn't it? But and speaking of same old, it wouldn't be the same without the old mate Booker. How are you this evening, my dear?
Speaking of same old, I loved
I thought
your
that was such a smooth segue. You know, it's It's you, isn't it? It's you. He says again, you know, people are not sick of this crap yet. You know, it's just like, you know, 70, I mean, 76 Aspies, we've done 75 episodes of this nonsense.
I'm getting excited, you know, like 100, though. That'll be exciting, 100, don't you think?
We need to make that, you know, the decent one. You know, make it a good one.
Yeah, make that the decent one. Okay.
Yeah, instead of the other 99 were a bit iffy, but yeah, 100's going to be a knockout. Definitely. So all good stuff. So yeah, it's how have you been and whatnot?
I've been good. You know what? You know what I did today? I slept.
I took two naps, and I'm still kind of tired. Did you actually manage to do anything other than that? Because you didn't get out of bed till what, 11? So that's great. You know, that's a skill set right there. Is fitting in two naps between 11 a.m. and 9:35 p.m. That's great. I can't even fit in lunch. You know.
I had the two naps out of the way by like 3:30. I did. I don't know how I managed it, but it was nice. Let's see, is that all I did? No, that's not all I did. I read a little bit today.
Steady on.
That's all.
Though.
I read and I
slept. Well, I'll tell you something. I mean, you know, obviously, I'm a little bit older than you are. You know, I at what age does a power nap become just a nap? You know what I mean? I remember in the 80s, the yuppies and all that, power nap was the thing. I was going to have a power nap.
Yeah.
20 minutes. For me, a power nap's nodding off in Futurama, tell you the truth. That's my power nap.
I can take a good I can take a 20-minute nap and be good and be refreshed and everything. Now it's the boyfriend. I'm gonna take a nap. 4 hours later, I hear from him and I'm thinking that's not a nap. That's a sleep. That's not a nap. 4 hours.
Yeah, that's a good night's sleep for some people.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I don't even sleep 4 hours. You know, during the night. So.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, if I have a lunch, like, you know, something other than a banana and a tin of Monster, you know, I'll nod off. Sometimes I just have a bowl of cereal, but if I have anything that's sort of carbohydrate heavy, and I do like my carbohydrates, people, it'll put me to sleep, you know, and I'm just working day, I tend to sort of write, you know, writing, creative, you know, sort of raw stuff of a morning, and then afternoon do, you know, editing, business stuff, that sort of thing. Because, you know, that my brain is more sort of active. But, yeah, if I sort of have a break and I'll, you know, have a, you know, something that's a bit carbohydrate-y, the next minute, I'm like you say, but instead of fighting it, the best thing to do is just literally close, you just have 10, 15 minutes. And it's surprising how refreshing that is. It does work.
I'm like a toddler, though. I'm going to fight it and fight it until, you know, I just fall out pretty much. And I will. You know, I'll be nodding off and you know, my stupid Kindle will hit me in the face and I'll still just keep trying as hard as I can.
I'll close my eyes and I'll finish this chapter. I'm editing this chapter or, you know, proofreading or whatever. But your brain's going, no, I'm tired now, actually, yes. Fucko. And I tell you, I mean, speaking of tired and worn out things, I think I made a comment on Facebook. Kirk Douglas at the Golden Globes. What? Why? They wheeled the old boy out. He looked as confused as anything, bless him.
Oh,
you know, it's like, didn't it? I mean, he's 101, bless him. You know, he should be home with his slippers in front of the fire. You know, watching The Young and the Restless, perhaps. Or Spartacus, maybe, you know. And he just looked like, you know, he had no idea who Catherine Zeta-Jones was. It's like, oh, I mean, she's attractive and she should put a vest on, he was thinking. And he was wondering you could tell, he was like, when's the bingo coming on?
Oh, God.
He was just like, bless him. You know, he sending the wheel out the old people. You know, he's Doris and she's 106, you know. She just like, just let me die. You know, she's in her home. She can't muster up enough strength to blow the bloody candles out on the cake they've made. She's like, and yet they're on about, oh, we can extend human life, like, you know, to 200. And, well,
oh,
that's
God.
Great, isn't it? Yeah, that's 120 years in an old folks home. Thanks a fucking lot. You know, I mean, great. Thanks a bunch.
That's our goal.
What they need to do is to extend it at the other end. So your childhood is like 80 years. And then you do your grown-up rubbish, you know. And then instead
like
of prolonging life at the back end, when your body's pretty much had enough, you know. And it depresses me. It really does. You know, they're just there. So I'm ready for my grave now. And they're, no, blow your candles out, Grandma. I don't, let me die. We bought you an iPad. What is that? I don't know what that is. It's newfangled wizardry.
Maybe it's because I'm getting
older and I'm a little bit sensitive. Hopefully I'll get to 101 and they'll wheel me out so I can wonder who the hell Catherine Zeta-Jones is,
You keep up more with, current events, I think, than I do. I can't remember the last time I turned my TV on. I mean, I watch shows, but I watch, like, Netflix, and that's it. I never, in news, forget about it. It's depressing, and it's
well, to
morning,
be fair,
I
get all my news goings on from online newspapers and online stuff. TV is mostly SpongeBob. or cartoons, or yeah. I mean, it's funny. I'm binge watching season two of Channel Zero. So I was thinking, series one was Candle Cove. This is No End House, and it is as creepy as hell. I mean, it's like Stranger Things, but like with the creepiness factor cranked up to 11. It is. Heartily recommend it, folks. I really do. It's good. And the first season was brilliant. I binge-watched Black Mirror Season 4 over Christmas, which was great. So I'll tend to do that. You know, I'll binge-watch a whole bunch of stuff, you know, whole season. And I like to catch British sitcoms when and where I can because, you know, they're funny as opposed to the American sitcoms, which are not funny.
They've gotten so bad. I mean, I used to really laugh at, like, Friends. I loved Friends. But some of that, like, okay, there was one. There's one now that I thought it had so much promise, and the one chick who is one of the main characters or whatever. I love her. I think she's adorable. But the show sucks. It's Two Broke Girls. I think that Cat Chick.
Oh,
or whatever
that
her name
is so.
She is
incredibly badly written. It really,
yes,
you can see the jokes coming a mile off, and when they do come, they're not funny. I mean, they're just really... I watched a couple of those.
I think the actresses themselves, the actors and stuff, I think they realize how bad it is, and they don't even try anymore. They just deliver the lines, and they're not even trying to act. I've seen that girl in other things before, and she was a good actor. So to see her acting so badly, it's like a choice.
Big Bang Theory. You know, it was good. The first two seasons were good. I'm sticking with it because I kind of like. It's a nice bit of nonsense, but it is. They run these things to death, you know, and it's not. You know, a lot of the fun premise is out of it. You've got Sheldon's in a relationship and getting married, and it's just wrong.
Don't tell me. I'm only on season 8, and I am watching
sorry.
It right now. I love
he may
that
or
show.
May not
I
be
do.
Getting married, but I still watch it. I still enjoy it.
Have they had sex?
Well, do you want me to spoil it? Yes, they have coitus. They have had coitus on several occasions. But they tend to do it birthdays and special occasions. It's just kind of funny. I find that creepy because he's so childlike. It's almost like she's sleeping with a 9-year-old. And it's also, I'll tell you what is good, though, is Young Sheldon, which is like the prequel. It's Sheldon as I think 10-year-old, and that is really good. You know, they don't have a laugh track to it. It's not knocked down funny, but it's great. It is really.
Yeah.
I think it's actually going to outshine the original. It's good. Another tip there. Another tip. I should be getting handouts and kickbacks from Fox, I think.
Yeah, you should.
So, hey, anywho, we have a bit of a special show tonight. We have sort of horror royalty joining us this evening. We have Stanley Wiotta, hopefully I have pronounced his name correctly, 3 times Bram Stoker Award-winning author, creator of the Dark Dreamers series, in which he speaks to some of the absolute greats in horror. You know, I'm almost nervous, actually. I want to cue him in, but I'm frightened because I'm just going to go all, you know what I mean? But I think let's bring Stanley. I hope he's going to be kind to us. Stanley, are you there, sir?
I'm there. I am here.
Yay.
Hello.
You are there.
Hello.
And
we bow down before you, sir. We bow. What an absolute corker of a resume you have. How are you this evening?
I'm fine, and I greatly appreciate the compliments. I'll take them where I can get them.
I'm sure you've had more than one. So whereabouts are you based? Where are you calling us from?
In Massachusetts, Western Massachusetts. It's 10:45 our time here. And
oh,
I
wow.
took two
oh,
power
so
naps.
You took
two
power
naps
as well.
Myself, yeah, to make sure I can make it to this time.
Awesome. I must say, I went down the monster route, so I had a tin of monster earlier. So.
Oh,
and
no,
a banana.
Did you really?
I did. And a banana, which is good for energy and high in potassium. So, and it's probably the only fruit I'll eat, but other than that, and strawberries. I don't apples, not apples. Can't be doing with oranges and whatnot, you know. So. So you could have a whole segment about, pardon the pun, whole segment about fruit, but let's not.
Or not.
Or not. So I don't know where to start, Stanley. I mean, the Dark Dreamer series, which went out in the UK and Canada, I understand, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, who haven't you interviewed? I mean, some of the, Clive Barker, I mean, there's I'm probably Clive's biggest fan. I've got to ask you, what is Clive like on a personal level?
Very nice. He's very kind and continuously surprised that he has such a following. You know, when we ask about his fans, he says, "Oh no, please don't call them my fans." He says, "Please call them my readers or my viewers." He says, "I don't want to be part of a fan of situation." Which of course he is, very deeply.
No, yeah, he's. I think I've told this story before. I mean, I remember back in the sort of I guess late 80s when I picked up the Books of Blood. See, I just bought all six books. Read them start to finish, and it actually stopped me writing for about 10-15 years because I was just so blown away by the originality, the style, just everything. There's no way on God's planet I could even come close to this, you know. And so I literally just stopped me writing. I stopped writing horror. I actually went on to writing comedy, funnily enough. So it's only really in recent years I sort of plucked up the courage to write horror again. So yeah, thanks, Clive, if you're listening. But I mean, true inspiration. I mean, you know, I obviously. In that respect, inspired me to wait until I was mature enough to even be, you know, in the same genre as him.
Yeah, well, when Clive Barker burst on the scene with Books of Blood, you know, he hadn't published in the magazines or had it published in the small press, and when he came full blown with Books of Blood, the rumors had it that it was actually Ramsey Campbell writing under a pseudonym because no one had such explosive style or quirky style as Ramsey did. And people at first assumed Clive Barker, what a made up name. You know, no one's going to buy that name except for Ramsey Campbell. And Ramsey loved it most of all. People thought that Clive Barker was an imaginary character.
Oh, that is fantastic. Yeah. It does sound like a made up name, doesn't it?
It does. Clive Barker.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like when King came up with Richard Bachman, you know, it was like a pretty, you know, bog standard name, really, you know, I guess. I mean, yes, obviously you interviewed Clive and. I'm in awe of you. I really am. So how did you get involved with the whole scene, the whole Dark Dreamers thing. Was that your concept, or somebody came to
you
with it?
That was my concept. That was my concept. I was an entertainment reporter for some Western Massachusetts newspapers, and whenever there was a chance to interview a horror author, I naturally went for it. And this was also just as Fangoria magazine was coming on the scene. I was first published in issue number 6 and was in the first 100 or so issues. But it was the idea that at that time, it was just when King and Barker and the whole scene was exploding, and people were being recognized for the great that work, Richard Matheson, Harlan Ellison. And I looked around and I said, well, why isn't anybody reporting on these folks? So I had an open field, and ultimately became what some people say was a big fish in a very small pond.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you said, I mean, he sort of exploded, I would say, so late 70s through the 80s. I mean, I grew up on James Herbert, obviously being from England. He was my first introduction to grown-up horror. And it was just mind-blowing stuff. It was so raw and visceral and so different from, obviously, the young adult and kids horror that I'd sort of had until then. And I'd read Stoker, I'd read Frank, John Wilson was a favorite, a lot of those classics. And Herbert just came out and just blew the whole thing right open. I think at one point he was actually outsold Stephen King over in England. So there he is, that British Stephen King.
Yeah.
You know?
I was fortunate to interview James. Never had the good fortune to meet him, but I interviewed him over the phone and sent him a couple books to sign, and he was kind enough to sign them and send them back and said, I hope you'll read these someday. Which, of course, I already had. He is like most authors. Once they make it, they're wondering, is anybody really reading my books, or they just want my autograph?
Well, I hope one day I get to that point. People just... Maybe nice if they read the books, but just buying them is a good start, So, again, Herbert was... He used to pop up on British chat shows a lot. Obviously, every time I had a book out, he'd be on the chat show circuit. And again, he came across as a genuinely nice bloke. He started off in marketing, that's his background in advertising, and he just seemed such a nice guy. And it's funny how horror writers seem to be some of the nicest bunch of people you could ever meet. And I guess people outside...
It's surprising,
People outside the genre assumes that we're all horrible, dark, nasty, psychopathic, child killers. But we're not.
Like,
we're nice people.
Like, I talk to you all the time, James, and I think you're just, the greatest. And then I read you, and I'm like, oh, my God, I don't know if I'd want to be alone with you. Which is awful.
Well,
it's weird, but
maybe we're nice because we all the nastiness is written out of us. We get all that out. So when you actually when it's us, we're nice because all the dark stuff's gone. It's all written down.
So we should fear these comedy writers is what we should do.
That's
there
it.
There's no outlet.
When you read their backgrounds, you would say, I would never want to be a comedy writer because of the tragedy and pathetic lifestyles, or I should say childhoods, that they had, whereas the horror writers, none of them are seeing psychiatrists because all their fears and horrors and traumas are out on paper, often
from
an early age. So they're
the most
well-adjusted people I know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you should look at some of the comedy greats, and they're all tortured souls. I mean, literally to a man.
Yeah.
I think, and I've done comedy, and I've worked in comedy, and there is an element of, it's like, certainly when you do stand up, you know, it's you know, your instant gratification, and yet it can be instant rejection. You know, when you write a book and it goes out there and people buy it, people, well, you know, you don't get upset every time somebody doesn't buy a book. You stood on stage, you tell a gag that you've labored over, you know, this is the funniest thing ever, and nobody laughs, and there is nothing more soul crushing than that. And it's just, and yet it's just that instant boom, you know, you get that fever. Same as sales, you know, you're working a sales job, you know, and you get that, you have to be used to rejection. And we speak to authors who, you know, they write one book and get a rejection slip and never write anything again. Because, oh, I've got a rejection, you know, instead of, right, you pick yourself up, you write another book, you know, and just keep going, for goodness sake, you know.
On the other hand, it could be decades before you get any personal satisfaction or professional satisfaction for being a writer. The horror writer Dennis Etchison once told me that that's one of the hardest things of being in this business, of writing, you know, a book or a story in 1980, and it takes, you know, 30 years before someone comes up to you at a convention and say, you know, that story changed my life, or that story scared the hell out of me. And he
but
said,
I mean,
can you imagine waiting 30 years to have one say, I love that novel, or I love that short story that you wrote 30 years ago?
That's crazy. Yeah.
But I think if you look at that on the other side of the coin, it also means that that piece of work that you wrote has been around
for 30 years.
Yeah. It's out there. I mean, for me, I mean, you know, a big part of it is getting it out on the paper, just getting it there, seeing it, and then, yeah, knowing it's out there. And even if one person reads it, you know, that's what it's about. Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice if, you know, 2 million people bought the book and read it. But, you know, as you say, Stanley, I mean, it takes time. I mean, for every Clive Barker who bursts onto the scene, you know, there's, you know, 100,000 others who are laboring away day in, day out, you know, happy to get, you know, $25 short story payment, you know, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think if we all did it for the money, there'd be like three horror writers, I think. Just like, let's do something else. Let's go, you know, push trolleys around Kroger. That'd be getting rid of the money doing that, you know.
And it's one of the worst,
you're going to get a paycheck.
Yeah, it's one of the worst ways in the world to make a living, to be a writer, to be any kind of artist, but especially a writer.
I mean, people often say, why, you know, why do you write? And I can only speak for me, but, you know, a lot of writers I speak to, you know, we write because we have to.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a choice. I've always wanted to write since I knew what books were, literally. You know, all my friends at elementary school wanted to be firemen and policemen and doctors. I wanted to write books, and that's all I ever wanted to do. And, you know, it's because it's either that or all those stories are still in there, you know what I mean? And I say, Eckstein has read some of my stuff. You know, it's not healthy. Not healthy. that should still be up there. It's good that it's out. It's good that it's out. Get them all out. But, of course, you write one out and there's another three or four just waiting in the wings to jump in. And you think, you know, you never get to a point where I've now written everything that's in there. That's
right.
It, I'm done. You know, I've written all my stories are out now, because it's not. It's just like, it's like King. I mean, he doesn't need the money. He's not writing for the money. You know, he's probably doing it, I would guess, because he has to. Otherwise, they're just all going to stack
absolutely.
Up in there. And it's the same reason McCartney. You know, he's still writing tunes. He doesn't need the money. He's worth something like $800 million. He doesn't need the money. But they're still in there. I think they would drive him mad, I think, if he didn't write them down.
Yes.
Yep. There's definitely times when I have to write. I need to write, and even if nothing comes out, there will be this itch in me or something that, you know, you have to write. There's something, and it may take a couple of days for something to come out, but until it does, it plagues me. Like, I can't do anything else, but, you know, but I'm thinking of it all the time, and I wonder if it's like that for everybody. You know, I don't know.
I think those of us that stick with it because we have to. I can only speak for me, and I couldn't not. Literally, I'll get an idea and it'll form in my head, and it's so strong. Unless I even, you know, I'll jot it down on my phone or write it on a scrap of paper just to get it out there. Although my age now, I'm more worried I'm going to forget it. You know, and it's almost, and it took me a long time to realize that not everybody, and everybody's brain works the same way. I said everybody was making stuff up. It wasn't until my wife said, you know, I really admire what you're doing. It was, well, what? I just literally just make shit up. I lie for a living. That's what I do. And she, I can't. I don't do that. My brain, and it's like, oh,
yeah.
Right, oh, well, that's a revelation. I didn't know that. There you go.
Comedians draw from real life, and it's usually horrible stuff that they make funny. You know, they say comedy is pain plus timing, whereas, you know, to me, horror is time plus pain equals salvation. You know, you get the pain out on paper or on film, and you're saved by it. You're not tortured by it for the rest of your life.
Yeah,
it is. It is like an exorcism. You know, once it's out there, and you know, I find that even then, you know, you go back to the story, because when you go back to story, you have to rewrite, to edit, and all the rest of it. You know, it's harmless then, because it's out. You know, you're on the screen or you're on the paper. You're not in my head now. You know, and whilst I'm still developing it, but that raw idea, that embryo of an idea, is not torturing my brain cells anymore. But then again, like say, you know, in the gap that left, there's another one jumps in and as a go. So and the worst thing I find with when I'm writing is I'm writing one thing, my brain's thinking about the next thing, and I can sometimes struggle to focus because I'm thinking about the next. I'm gonna have to think, no, I need to fit, otherwise all I would have is a whole selection of half finished novels and half finished short stories, because I've got halfway through and I moved on to the next one because the idea's there. I would never have finished. Sometimes it's a struggle to finish that second half, I find.
Poor
tortured souls.
we have a sound clip, don't we, from Dark Dreamers, James? I was looking at it earlier.
Yes, we do. Stanley sent that along. And would you like to introduce it for us, Stanley?
I picked it out, so I don't think he can.
Oh, sorry, I thought Stanley had sent it. I believe it's the Wes Craven interview.
Mhm. At least some of it, yeah.
Yeah. I've introduced. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the Wes Craven interview, Stanley?
Well, I went to his home out in California, out in Beverly Hills, and I developed a very nice relationship with Wes. And again, like most people in the horror business, he was incredibly kind and incredibly generous with his time, and always a bit confused as to why people paid attention to him beyond his movies. And the one thing I'll mention about his house is that He made a point of mentioning it used to be Steve McQueen's house. So it was up in the hills of Beverly Hills, and it had glass and to look out to the swimming pool, and the swimming pool was on a cliff, and you had a view of the valley beyond. So that's one of the things I remember, was that I was an enormous fan of Steve McQueen. So to be sitting in Wes Craven's living room interviewing him for the show, and at the same time trying to soak up the vibes of the ghost of Steve McQueen, perhaps.
Wow.
That is astounding. Because it's funny, you think, I mean, they, to them, you know, I bought Steve McQueen house, or, you know, I'm living in, you know, Marilyn Monroe's apartment or whatever. You know, to them, that's just their life. To us, it's like these people are gods. Actually interviewing Wes Craven in Steve McQueen's old house is just, you couldn't make that up, really, could you?
Right.
That is just amazing. So, well, look, okay, we're gonna play the clip from Dark Dreamers. It's about 6 minutes, so gives it Christina time to go and crack open another bottle of wine. So here we go.
Are you a dark dreamer? It is said that to best enjoy the light, you must first explore the heart and soul of the darkness. We are the artists who create in the shadows, whose dreams are designed to become your reality. I'm Stanley Weotter. Welcome to my world of the dark fantastic. Welcome to the world of dark dreamers. Are you a dark dreamer? Wes Craven undoubtedly is. The writer and director of some of the most frightening films ever made, Wes Craven is internationally recognized as one of the greatest dark dreamers of our time. Beginning in 1972 with the shocker Last House on the Left, which was produced by his colleague Sean Cunningham, Craven has since gone on to direct a long string of both popular and critically acclaimed motion pictures. Among his best known is a series that began in 1984 with A Nightmare on Elm Street. It became a pop culture phenomenon and spawned no less than 6 sequels and a television series. If that weren't enough, for the Christmas holiday season of 1996, Craven treated us to Scream. This also became a smash hit and generated 2 successful sequels. Wes recently invited us to his office in Los Angeles, where we discussed the life and career of one of our most accomplished dark dreamers.
Do you think part of the respect that the genre now has is because people are finally realizing that fact that there is that need for horror entertainment, as David J. Scowl, the critic, calls it, as a good part of our lives?
I don't know. You know, frankly, I have not felt that yet. I think I've felt a respect that they are economically very viable, and that they can be sold to a broader audience. But all you need to look at is like the opening of Scream being shown in Congress as an example of how despicable and irresponsible films are, to realize that they're not out of the woods at all insofar as public opinion goes, certainly not the opinion of policymakers. John McCain hates what I do. I'm sure he thinks it's un-American. And I've been being called that. Somebody called Last House on the Left the most subversive film he'd ever seen, you know, and was clearly anti-American. So I don't know. And you know, Columbine, the first thing they hit was horror films. You know, it's like whatever opportunity they can to get a suggestion that these films are truly detrimental and undermining to the American way of life, they will take it and try to squelch them. And right now is not a good time for making horror films. Dimension Films has swung around to making children's films or remakes of classics, you know. So they are always live rounds, you know, and I think a lot of people are still profoundly uncomfortable with them and will readily say that they are irresponsible and that films are for entertainment. And that means giving people pleasant feelings, or it seems to be the implication is take them away from reality, take them away from thinking about what's unpleasant, and make them feel good about life, whatever. And there are times when, believe me, lately I've sat down with a silly film, you know. But that makes perfect sense to me. If the reality that I do films about is clear and present in reality, then you don't need to make a film about it. It's when people are like going along like those things don't exist is when those films are doing their function.
And we had the recent horrible tragedy in New York, and one of the reactions that the film and television industry had was to immediately put aside or put on the shelf films that might remind the audience of either the World Trade Center or terrorism in general. Do you think this is the right thing to do or an improper thing to do in terms of trying to, like, well, we have terrorism in real life, we better not talk about it in fiction for a while?
It's a delicate matter. You know, I think I've often referred to horror films as an inoculation against true horror. If a patient has a disease, you know, they're in the middle of a raging fever and fighting for your life, you're not going to inoculate them with more of the disease, you know. So I can understand that. I don't think it should be done officially. I think unofficially it will be done. People probably aren't going to see Towering Inferno right now, you know, at the video store. But if they need to in some way, if they need to somehow, for whatever mysterious psychological reasons, need to watch it in a way that is resolved rather than so open-endedly, confusingly, bafflingly, horribly unsolvable as it feels right now, they should be able to do that, you know. But I understand the impulse. It was so uncanny, I think, to everybody, including filmmakers, how close it was in a way to the cinematic visions of the last 10 years. And I got to tell you, beyond making money in the film business, beyond all that stuff, there are perceptions that people who make films and write scripts have about potentials that wake you up in the middle of the night, and you make a script about that. And I swear to God, there is a part of you that says, I hope they see this and figure out how to make that impossible, you know. Ironically, they didn't. I mean, my novel, Found Society, ends with some guy crashing an airplane into the project in order to bring it to an end. I mean, why the hell, some general said, you know, when asked, why didn't you have some system of protection of protecting the Pentagon? He says, well, it never occurred to us somebody would fly a plane into it. Well, duh, you know? I mean, it's not like poor lowly little horror films haven't suggested a lot of these things. So, you know, my old phrase of making movies that are scenarios for the apocalypse or boot camp for the psyche, I mean, that was my vision, that was my hunch, and I wish I had been wrong, but I wasn't.
Wow, yeah, that was intense stuff. That was intense stuff. So, I think a lot of sort of issues brought up there. I mean, was Wes very sort of introspective in that respect?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he was, he had the mind of a college professor or a very well-read man, very intelligent. And of course, a lot of people assume that people who make horror movies are just, you know, money-grubbing hacks and have no artistic intent in what they're doing, or don't have an intellectual mind knowing what they're doing when they make a horror film.
Yeah, I think because of some of the issues that certainly was raised there, people in the horror industry probably have to be more philosophical and more introspective. You know, we probably analyze our work more than I think any genre. It's funny, you look at some of the mindless action movies that are just they churn out, and people getting blown and all the rest of it, and yet nobody points the finger at them. I mean, there was a famous case in England 20 odd years ago now, where two young boys aged I think 10 11 kidnapped a 2-year-old toddler. Took him away from a shopping center, tortured and killed him. Immediately they pointed, because one of the boys had seen Child's Play, they pointed to that. Child's Play was pulled off the shelves in England for a good number of years because of that one incident.
Wow.
And then somebody said, well, you know, okay, fair do, but even if they hadn't seen, these boys would have done this anyway. Because no matter what they saw, no matter how, you know, it's not the film that's made them do this. It's the fact that's their mindset that made them gravitate towards the film. Because they actually did what they did to the little boy, you know, replicated some of the stuff that they've seen on the film. So, we have to be well-read and, you know, more analytical with what we write and what we film, because we need to be able to defend ourselves, I think.
Exactly. I was just going to say that you have to be able to mount a good defense instead of people accept comedies at face value, action movies at face value, just about any genre they'll accept at face value. But, oh, my God, you made a horror movie. You're destroying society from within.
Yes. Yes. We're subversives that we are.
Yes.
We are going to need to take a quick break here. And James has to take a wee, of course. And I think I need more wine again.
Yeah, thanks
I didn't
for
have
that.
Enough. You're welcome.
Actually, I do. Always do this time of night. But
So don't go anywhere, okay, Stanley?
All right, dear. Be right here.
Okay, and I guess I have commercials this week, right? I'm all excited and tongue-tied, and you're going to make me do commercials. And
yeah, you need to do commercials, and then we're going to go to a break.
Okay, here we go. The Panic Room Radio Show is sponsored by Hellbound Books, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher along with links to all their available works across platforms at hellboundbookspublishing.com. Hellbound Books is proud to be the first in the indie publishing business with their very own app on both Google Play and the App Store. In the mood for something steamy to read, check out new erotica author Jennifer Lynn's website at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James at his website, www.jameslongmore.com, and Xtina has an author page found on the Hellbound website. Don't forget to follow the Panic Room Radio Show on social media. Our Facebook page, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show, Twitter at Panic Room Radio, our YouTube channel, The New Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website at www.panicroomradio.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah. And now, as previously announced, it's break time. Teenage Rampage from The Sweet. I picked out 70s music this week. This is all music from my childhood. That took me right back. I mean, the first tune was ballpark incident by Wizard, Roy Wood and Wizard. Roy Wood, who was one of the co-founders of the Electric Light Orchestra, who we played the week before. So there you go. It's all linked. All clever stuff, isn't it?
You do great.
And hey,
you do. Yeah.
I, you know, I'm that bloody old. You know, I know that much music. You know, it's hopefully, if I can get it, hopefully a really special treat for next week. But I'm not going to spoil it. Speaking of special treats.
Oh, hey. Looks like it's time to review something. Oh, no.
It's Becky the Reviewer. How are you, Mom?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine, too, y'all.
She's fine. Now, how come she gets
a special... I'm fine.
She gets special treats, and I get things like, you know, my alcoholic friend, and you know, and... Just, I'm not talking to you.
Yeah, fair. I don't forget who presses the buttons here. So, Becky the Reviewer, what have you got to review for us this evening?
Well, it's a book that is published by Hellbound, and it's written by Donna Maria McCarthy, and it's called Biddy Trot. Is that right?
That is correct, yeah. And what a fine book.
Yes, it really, really is really good. It's a really dark gothic tale. It's set in England.
Yay!
I was waiting. I knew that was coming.
I should put the national anthem on and stand up, you know, and salute the Queen and whatnot. But, yeah.
I'm going to succeed
it. The town where the story takes place is small, but there was a young girl accused of starting a fire, and they hunted her down and tortured her and murdered her. And the townsfolk were all part of it, and they were, it didn't seem to bother them. And then you have a guy named Abner who enters this town, and he sees all these things going on and some really, really unspeakable things. And he decides he can't leave, that he has to stay and write down all the things he sees. It's a really twisted tale. It is told absolutely brilliantly. I mean, she can really write a good story. Her characters are so full, and the imagery that, you know, she makes you see when you read all this is just phenomenal. I really, really, really was impressed. I really liked it.
I think that one of the things I liked about it as well, because I mean, Donna, obviously she's a Brit, and we Brits, you know, rule, obviously. You know, she's written it in, you know, ye olde Englandy style, but it is,
yes.
It's not. I mean, I read Geoffrey Chaucer many times. I was forced to read it, and what a pile of crap that was, to be honest. Indecipherable. I mean, even Shakespeare,
yes,
with all this forsooth and that, nobody talks like that. Move on, modernize it a bit. Yeah, you know, they've even modernized. They've got modern versions of the Bible. You know, so Shakespeare needs. But anyway, you know. So, but she's captured, you know, the tone of ye olde England.
Right
there, you know, in the rat infested streets and the you know, open sewers and the straw strewn roads. It's, you know, it's great. I mean, I'm not going to spoil the story, but it's a great, creepy little story that just gets in your head and festers there.
Fester.
What a great word, fester.
And I really
love
it.
I'm going to say that every week. I was thinking my word of the week.
Well, I remember when we had Andrew. Oh my gosh. What was his last name? Oh my gosh, I feel awful. I can see him.
McKay.
Andrew McKay, another Brit, yeah?
No, the Rot. It's all Rot, that guy. What was his name? It's Andy. Andy? Was it Andy? Andy Peliquin. Yes, it's all Rot.
Andy
Peliquin,
yes. Peliquin, yes.
That was my phrase for like a good week or two. It's all
Rot.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, Becky, how many Becky stars are you giving Biddy Trot?
Becky stars.
I would give it 9.5.
God, Becky
stars.
This is going to be a thing.
Woo-hoo!
9.5.
That's awesome.
They'll be merchandise, you mark my words. It'll be Panic Room merchandise. I earned 5 Becky stars, it'll say. It'll be great.
She needs to review Dark Musings now. If we, you know, giving out stars
yes.
like that, I want like 12 stars. Can I get 12 stars?
Yeah,
what,
but you can't. No, you can't pre-book it. You can't pre-book the number of stars. Seriously. So anyway, Becky, thank you so much for joining us and lighting up our little otherwise dull day. You know, it's always look forward to you coming and being a little happy little soul for us, which is brilliant. And thank you for the review. We shall look forward to seeing you. She's fine, y'all. And we will look forward to speaking to you next week.
Thank you, Becky.
Okay, Becky.
Thank you.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
There we go. There it is. Love it. Bye. Oh, she's always happy. She's always happy. I love it. Anywho, we need to bring Stanley back. Stanley, are you still there, sir?
Yes, sir. Right here.
Hello. Thank you for bearing with us. we have to do this stuff, you know. So you know what, you know the drill. I have to ask. I mean, you're sort of the guy that's brought together a lot of my, you know, big loves of the industry. The Twilight Zone scripts. Tell me more about those.
Yes, this was. An idea of mine that I had that everyone said that Richard Matheson, and I've had the pleasure of editing several of his short story collections as well as the Twilight Zone scripts into 2 volumes. But everyone said back in the day that next to Rod Serling, the best and most frightening scripts on that show were written by Richard Matheson. And I said to him on an occasion, wouldn't it be great to have those published? And he said, no one ever thought about it. No one's ever approached me. And at that time, I was working with Cemetery Dance on a book called The Stephen King Universe. And I said to Richard Chismer, our Cemetery Dance, wouldn't we be great if we could do this? And Richard said, I'm all for it. All you have to do is take the original script formatting. He says, I don't want it to be published as, you know, not kind of a short story font, but, you know, script font. It's got to be looked like you actually reproduce my actual scripts. So we went along with that, and I asked him, I said, do you think I could ask you the origin of every story? Since there's only 14 of them, that shouldn't be too much of a task for you. And he agreed to that. I was shocked, but he agreed to that. So I was able to do a 2-volume collection in paperback, 1-volume in hardcover, of all his scripts, with me interviewing him to get the genesis of each and every of the 14 scripts. And it's still in print, and I'm very proud to have been part of it. And Richard thanked me in the beginning of the book for being the person who came up with the idea to have this done. And now there's the Twilight Zone scripts of Charles Beaumont, the Twilight Zone script of Earl Hamner is out there, the Twilight Zone scripts of George Clayton Johnson. So everybody who wrote more than 1 or 2 scripts has now gotten onto that, and I'll call it a bandwagon, for lack of a better term, of publishing their Twilight Zone scripts. So I was very proud to kick off that bandwagon.
Wow, that is. Probably, you know, a bit of a cliche, but I think everybody in the genre loves the Twilight Zone. I mean, funnily enough, actually, I spent my New Year's Eve watching old Twilight Zone episodes, and you know, they are awesome. They still stand up. They are. I'm going to stick my neck out here. They are probably better written than 90% of the stuff that's churned out today. They are such tight, beautifully written stories, great dialogue, great characters. They do the job. They creep you out. They stick in your head. Obviously shot on an incredibly tiny budget. But by Christ, they are effective. They are just some of the best stories, most unique stories around.
Every time there's a history of the greatest television series, the Twilight Zone always comes up number one as the best anthology, not science fiction, not horror, but the best anthology series in the history of television.
Yeah, I would agree. I think because they date back to the late '50s. They were probably the precursor for everything else.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember they revamped it in the 80s, and some big name directors shot some episodes, and I saw some of those. Again, I watched the first season. I'm going to watch that, and then I watched some of the 80s, like, and they were not a patch. Obviously, you know, the effects were there, and obviously a bigger budget, but they just seemed soulless to me. I think the early black and white ones were just so, you know, so. And I think, yeah, I think, you know, as a writer, I think that's probably what I appreciate more. Was the quality of the writing was just, I mean, like you say, the names you've just reeled off, Stanley, I mean, there's no wonder the writing was so damn good.
Well, believe it or not, they're bringing it back again. I'm not sure if it's Netflix or Showtime, but one of the premium cable organizations has just greenlit. I was reported in the Hollywood Reporter just a few weeks ago, a new revival of The Twilight Zone.
Oh, wow.
So again, right. You know,
keep bringing it back, rightly or wrongly.
I think after what they did in the 80s with it, I'd be very skeptical, hopefully. But then again, with the resurgence of the like of, you know, Black Mirror, which I guess is a modern day version, you know, which again is fantastic. You know, I think every one of those episodes was excellent. Obviously, you know, Stranger Things, and yeah, there seems to be that interest in the shorter episodes, the creepy, the supernatural, you know, that sort of thing. So
American Horror Story.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great writing in the horror genre, especially on episodic television or anthologies on television. Because of the streaming services and the premium cable.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's it. Like you say, when you've got, you know, the likes of Netflix and Hulu and Amazon are paying now for original material. And like you say, I mean, some of the best stuff that's coming out is on the streaming services, you know, whether they've got more money or they seem to have more freedom. You know, they seem to just, you know, the directors, the writers have a lot more scope. To do what they want, and they can be nearer the knuckle, and, you know, they're not bothered about upsetting sensitivities. As I say, I'm watching the second series of Channel Zero, and it's beyond creepy. It's disturbing. I mean, it's out and out disturbing, but in a good way. It's not throwaway horror, you know, that you watch it and you've forgotten it the next day. You know, it stays with you, and I think that's what a good horror story should be. It should stick in your head pretty much forever.
Yeah.
We need an ex-teener corner where I just tell you about some blonde moment that I've had during the show. We had one last week, and I remember how funny that was. And my blonde moment for this week, I just got it, okay? When you said that Channel Zero earlier, I thought you were telling me what channel this show was on, and I kept waiting to hear what the name of the show was, and you didn't tell me. So I was like, I don't know what Channel Zero is. Like, what channel is that? I mean, okay, I remember the old TVs where you would have it, you know, the black and white ones, but I was pretty sure you didn't have one of those.
I can see you now pressing the zero button on your remote.
Yes,
where is the channel? It's not
channel
zero.
Exactly.
Although I think on my TV, Channel Zero is actually the pay-per-view, so there you go. It would work.
So,
you're a strange woman. You really are.
I should probably not share these with everybody, but I started giggling, and I'm like, well, it's only fair that I let you know, everybody in on the secret why I'm giggling. I just got that.
You just say happily in your own little world. Okay, add a little bit of levity. I mean, I couldn't let the evening go by, Stanley, without asking you about the official Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles treasury. I mean, I'm a fan myself, I must confess. How did that come about?
Oh, that's not too bizarre a story. I actually went to college back in the 70s, which that does age me, but with Peter Laird, one of the two co-creators of Ninja Turtles. And at the time when he graduated, he found work by being self-employed. He owned a used bookstore in the basement of a building where he would go out on his bicycle. He didn't have enough money to own a car. He would go out on a bicycle and go to other used bookstores in Western Mass, buy books for 10 or 15 cents a piece, and then go back to his little bookshop, which is actually used to be a shoe repair shop, a little nook in the corner of a basement of the building, and sell them for a quarter or 50 cents. And he was doing that, and in the meantime, doing his sketches and trying to sell his sketches. And at that point, he really couldn't give them away until he met someone on a free bus service for the five colleges named Kevin Eastman. And they hit it off, and they were both struggling artists. And at one point, they sat there, and they were just doing sketches. And Peter Laird came up with or Kevin Eastman, I forget now which it was, but came up with a fighting Ninja Turtle. And Kevin Eastman said, "That's the Ninja Turtle," when Peter inquired. And Kevin said, "No, that's not a Ninja Turtle. That's a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle," because they were spoofing the trends at the time in the late 80s of comic books. So being a friend, a very close friend of Peter Laird's, when it came time to put the history of together back in the early 90s, they were kind enough to give me carte blanche to their archives, and I put together the treasury, and that book is still in print to this day as an e-book.
That is awesome.
And of course,
awesome.
That became probably one of the most successful, if not the most successful, independent comic line in history because of the merchandising.
Yes.
They agreed to have merchandising done and met with an agent. And on a napkin, just like you hear in the movies, the agent said, for every dollar made, we'll share it, and we'll each get a third of every dollar. So since at that time they owned the Turtles 100%, every item, and there ended up being hundreds and hundreds of different items with a Ninja Turtle logo on it, Peter and Kevin became multimillionaires because of it.
Fantastic. And of course, it had a resurgence of recent years. And I saw the first movie, and I loved it. It was great.
I don't remember which one it was, but there was one of the movies in like the 80s, I think it was, that this is so dorky. I had the soundtrack to it. I did. I loved all the songs on there. That's dorky, isn't it?
No, if it was the 80s, it would have been a slamming soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
It would be fantastic. It'd be fantastic. Yeah, but we went to see my daughter wanted to see the more recent one. We haven't seen the second one yet, and it was great. It was just, it was very self-referential. You know, say again.
The big rat dude kind of freaked me out. I don't know. Splinter. He was just creepy looking to me. I mean, he was a cool character and everything, but in one of the movies I remember seeing it again, it was back in the 80s. He just creeped me out. He did. Something about a giant rat is just a little creepy to me, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's giant rats, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah. I'm not a fan. Not a fan.
No.
No. I was wondering, Stanley, with all the people and the amazing, you know, people that you've interviewed, is there anyone that's, I'm sure a lot of them do, but do you have a favorite? Anyone that like really sticks out that you're like, man, that was amazing.
Well, I always tell people if I only could pick one,
interview for them to go to get a taste of what I try to do is it's the Harlan Ellison interview.
Yeah.
And it's not because I'm so brilliant at interviewing Harlan Ellison. It's just that Harlan Ellison is Harlan Ellison. And it was a situation where he's given, you know, probably hundreds of interviews in the course of his lifetime. But when I interviewed him, we had already been friends for several years. So when I went to his home and we sat in his kitchen and had a conversation, it was like the cameras weren't there. And we had a real conversation. And, of course, that meant I basically, you know, sat there and kept my mouth shut and let Harlan Ellison talk for a half hour.
Now, that's pretty cool. Yeah. Huh.
So I have to ask, and it's probably unfair of me to ask you, you don't have to answer, who's your least favorite?
He's not going to answer that.
Their name starts with blocked out. You know? It was nobody who was, you know, mean to me or cruel to me. Years ago, I interviewed William Shatner very early in my career, and he had promised me an interview. This is pre-original Star Trek, and I mean post-original Star Trek and pre-Star Trek the movies. And he was doing an episode of Kung Fu. If you remember that show with David.
I do.
Oh,
yeah.
God, I do. Yeah. My dad used to love that.
Yeah. There's another story of me getting stoned with David Carradine, but that's for another time.
Ooh.
But with William Shatner promising me an interview when he was guest starring on the show, and then he disappeared, and I found him in his makeup cabin. And, of course, he was being applied with like an hour's worth of makeup with false hair pieces and all this. So he couldn't move. So he was so obviously disappointed in me being there, but what could he do? Cause he had already made that promise that I could interview. But it was so obvious that every word I got out of him was, had to be pulled with pliers. So
I've heard that Shatner can be difficult, but yeah, I'm a big fan. It's funny, he was in some of the early Twilight Zones as well. I think that's probably where he started
The Richard Matheson's. Yeah, he was in Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. He was brilliant in that, and also the Nick of Time with him and his wife in the little diner and that little fortune telling machine. Well, that was. Seemed to be really telling the speech. But it was just a situation where, you know, you want to interview someone who's looking forward to it and wants to join in the conversation rather than someone said, who's this punk? You know, I'm tied in a chair and I've got to answer his questions, you know?
Yeah.
So, but he's still a great guy and I can't begrudge him, you know, all his success.
No.
I mean, he's in his 80s and he's still at it. He's still on TV.
He's been around. I mean, it's funny. We watched, I got hooked on Boston Legal when that was on. And he was just fantastic in that. You know, he was pretty much playing William Shatner, which is, I think, pretty much all he's ever done. But he was just a great, eccentric character in that. And you know, him and, who was the guy that played the other guy? Do you know, my brain's fried tonight. The other guy in Boston Legal.
Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Oh, you know what I mean. I'm going to have to Google it because I think it's been a long day. The two of them as a double act were just brilliant. There was not James. Was it James Spader?
Might have been. It might have been James.
Could have been.
Rings a distant bell. Might have been James Spader.
Yeah, but anyway, whoever that guy was. Yeah, I mean... It's a great show, you know, but Shatner's... I've heard, you know, quite a few reports that he can be awkward, but bless him. I mean, he must be a million years old by now. There's only him and George Takei left, I think, out of the original crew. Oh, Nichelle Nichols is still going.
And
she's still
Nichols.
Going. Mm-hmm.
And the actor who played the Russian.
Mr. Sulu.
Yeah, Mr. Sulu is still with us.
Which is ironic because the guy who played Mr. Sulu in the new films isn't.
Right.
Right. There's an irony there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But then Michelle Nichols turned up on Deadpool, wasn't it? She had a cameo in that, which is kind of groovy. But, yeah.
So I'm wondering what Stanley's favorite horror franchise is, like you know, Nightmare on Elm Street or Friday the 13th, Halloween. What's your favorite?
It's actually the Alien franchise of really? All the ones. There was something about that film when it came out in 1979. I saw it on the opening weekend. You know, this is pre-internet, pre-everything else, where everybody knew everything that was going. It opened cold. No one knew anything about it except for a couple of teaser trailers. And I walked in with some members of my family. And as we were watching it, when the chestburster scene came on, a bunch of people got up and headed for the exit. And I said, I'm going to love this movie. Because people literally got up and left the theater when that scene appeared. And
wow.
Over the years, I think it stood well the test of time. Not that everyone is a great film, but I think as a franchise, they've each have attempted to be unique in their own terms. I think it's time that they ended. I hope maybe that Ridley Scott gets his desire and does one final film to tie it all up. But after that, please leave it alone. It's, you know, the Alien Covenant was like kind of shaky to go into. Prometheus was kind of shaky to sit through. And I'm just hoping they do one, wrap it up, and put a bow on it from there.
No, I would agree. I would agree. I mean, they're sort of, yeah. I mean, the first one was just so, it's funny, I mean, because he opened here first, and back in England, I mean, I'd be, what was I, 16, 17? And we were getting all these reports about, yeah, people walking out, people fainting, people throwing up, and of course, you know, we've got to see this movie. And yeah, well, I think we saw it pretty much the opening weekend over in England. I mean, it was an 18, but we still managed to get in. And it was just mind-blowing. It was, you know, even now, I mean, it's one of those movies, you know, if I'm flicking through the cable channels and Alien's on, I'll watch it. And I've almost seen it dozens of times. And it still stands up. You know, now even you look at the you know, the technology, the computer technology, it still stands up. It still works, you know, and it's just phenomenal. You're still there. You're gripping the edge of your seat when it's stalking Ripley through the corridors of the spaceship as the self-destruct alarm's going off. And it is just so incredibly well done.
I like the second one. I like Aliens, I think, better than the first one.
I think Aliens was more of an action movie. I mean, they let Cameron loose with it, and it was an action movie. But it was incredibly well done. It's probably, in some respect, maybe, you know, a lot of people said it was better than the original. But I think for me, the original, because it was tight, it was, you know, small cast, it was more claustrophobic because they were just stuck on that ship. You know, it was just literally the alien stalking them, and that was the plot, and it worked so incredibly well, and the tension was just, it was palpable. You know, I don't think there's been anything like it, you know, anything close to it since, really.
And really, the last two films, as much as I personally enjoyed them, I don't think they add anything to, let's say the last two films, Prometheus and Alien Covenant, didn't exist. Would we really be missing them if they didn't exist as part of the franchise? I don't think so.
I would agree, Stan. I mean, for me, you know, they're going into the whole backstory or the explanation. For me, I mean, when Alien was Alien, it was just, you know, I mean, I like the twist that it was all sort of preordained, but the fact that they, you know, picked up an alien being on a planet and it killed them without all this backstory of engineering and that, like you say, you're right, you don't need that. It was just a nice, pure and simple horror film. You know, they did this, and it's the same as the films, you know, a bunch of kids conjure up a, you know, a demon, a devil, or Bloody Mary, or whoever. And it's exactly the same. We've done something, we've created this monster, and it's killing us. But it was so beautifully done, you know, and I defy anybody, even Ridley Scott, I don't think could top it.
It was good. Yeah. Did you see Leviathan? I seem to remember that back in, maybe late 80s, early 90s. Anybody remember that movie, Leviathan? It always gave me an alien feel. No? Okay, never mind.
No.
I didn't think it was that good. I'll say that. I didn't think it was
that with the monster on the ship?
Yeah.
And Jamie Lee Curtis? I think Jamie Lee Curtis was a female lead in that?
I think so. Yeah, it definitely was on the ship. It was definitely a monster. I didn't think it was that good, but it did give me an alien kind of feel to it. But
yeah, it definitely came out post, you know, the original Alien, which was 1979. You know, there were a lot of ripoffs of Alien. I think Leviathan was Alien on a ship.
Yeah.
You know, the alien monster on a ship. You know?
Yeah.
Even with Jamie Lee Curtis to play the Ripley role.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's it. It spawned a whole batch of, you know, strong female, which was great. You know, it was in itself an inspired move to have, Ripley, instead of being the archetypal horror film screaming, you know, terrified woman, you know, being the one who steps up and deals with it. You know, I enjoyed that. That was good. But I think, again, you know, from a writing point of view, the writing was so beautifully tight. You know, there wasn't one wasted word, not one wasted scene. It was just all fit so. It was just one of those perfect storms, you know, perfect film where everything worked, you know. I think for me, probably one, the only one that probably comes close, it for me, in perfectness, would be The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, the original, which was 81, I believe, not long after.
82.
Alien. I feel foolish.
Don't argue with me,
right?
I wouldn't dream of it. No. If you said it was 8, yeah. But it was because it was well written. It was very tight. It was very claustrophobic. They had the creature. You know, the effects were good, and it worked. You know, there weren't even any women in there. You know, it threw away the horror trope of, you know, you're large-breasted women getting stabbed to death by somebody. You know, you throw all that out the window, and it worked for it. You know, it's just somebody, Carpenter, daring to be different.
Yes. Well, I know we're coming close to the end of our time together. Yes.
Yeah,
we are, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I know. More time.
You don't want to have to have me plug my own books and DVDs, but if you twist my arm, I will, of course, say, you know, all my books, DVDs are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, a lot of, basically any place you can buy a DVD, you can get Dark Dreamers, either as the Best of Dark Dreamers, which is 10 episodes, or the complete two-season series, Dark Dreamers, which is 4 DVDs, and that's available. As well as my books are available as e-books. So I'm still out there for anybody who just says, God, I got to have more Stanley Weiner.
Oh, fantastic. And do you have a website as well, Stanley?
Yes, Stanley-Weiner.com. Plus, I have a Facebook page called Dark Dreamers Group, which is where anybody can go to and promote and plug themselves and or their products, as I've just shamelessly done.
Awesome.
No, shamelessly at all. That's what we're here for.
Definitely. And I have some of your links put up on our Facebook page, along with a link to the Dark Dreamers. The Best Of, I think, is what I put up there. But so if anybody wants to stalk Stanley, they can go there and do that. And definitely, we normally get to that part. We do. He was doing our job for us. I don't even know why we're here, James. This should be Stanley's show.
I'm I'm happy with that. We could have the night off. That'd be great. So yeah.
Yeah. That was awesome. It was.
Yeah.
There's so many times that we get to the part of the show where I say, okay, now where can we find you online? And do you want to, you know, tell us where your book can be found? And then they kind of go, and it takes them a while to tell us. So
well,
here,
I mean,
I like that.
Stanley's been on the other side of the coin, so he knows the score. He knows the score. I've got to get my plug in before the end of the show.
I don't want you guys to say, well, Stan, it was great talking to you, but I'm afraid we're out of time. We'll promote your work some other day.
Well, see, that would be a way to get you back on the show. You know, we didn't finish. We have to.
we've got to have you back on the show, Stan. This has been fantastic. What is next for you?
Well, I'm basically retired, to be perfectly honest, but I do have an article that I'm working on now for a book called Stephen King, Master Storyteller by Stephen Spignesi, who's one of the world's leading Stephen King experts. And it's titled The 13 Stephen King books you need if stuck in a desert island.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Anything Stephen King, I'm on board.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Yeah. And these are the 13. If you could only take 13 Stephen King books on a desert island, which would they be and why?
Oh, wow.
I like that question. Yeah.
I mean, for me, it would be the thickest ones because you're going to be there for a while and... You just need to read. So.
Well, you know, the bad part is one of my favorites is the thinnest, the very thinnest one I've ever read. The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. I absolutely love that book.
Yeah.
And it's
that was
so
a good
short.
One, yeah. You could read it in like an hour and a half. That's the problem, yeah.
Well, it took me a little longer than that, but...
Yeah, because you're having a nap.
Exactly.
She's having naps between chapters. There you go. Well, I'm afraid it is time now, so we're going to have to say goodbye, Stanley, I'm afraid. We will have you on again very, very shortly, hopefully. Yes?
Yes.
I would love that.
Yay,
brilliant.
You
wonderful.
Said it has to come back
brilliant.
Now.
It's been brilliant, thank you. So, and I'm afraid it is that time where we say goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.
Good night.